Welcome to the weekly podcast from the Church of England. This week, as the statistics on the number of people visiting cathedrals is released, we speak to the Dean of Newcastle about how they are attracting new visitors. We also hear from a charity set up to support farmers and from a vicar who has just returned from Calais, where he's been delivering supplies to the migrants living there. But first, figures released this week show over 10 million people visited England's cathedrals last year. The research shows that the highest motivating factors were for peace and contemplation, worship and music, and the friendly atmosphere. In 2014, the average number of adults and children attending cathedral services each week was 36,000, and the number of young people attending educational events at cathedrals increased by nearly 14% between 2004 and 2014. Over the last 10 years, the number of volunteers supporting the mission and ministry of cathedrals has also risen and is up to 15,200. The Very Reverend Christopher Dalliston, the Dean of St Nicholas Cathedral in Newcastle, told Rachel Harden more about the work they do.
We're really situated right in the heart of the city, right in the historic core of the city, but also in the clubbing district. We're probably very different to some places which are surrounded by big green spaces. We're absolutely kind of, in the kind of commercial and clubbing heart of the city. So it does call for us a particular kind of series of responses. And one of those is that the city's been developing as a tourist destination in quite a big way over recent years. And we've found the number of visitors coming to the cathedral who are coming to explore heritage, coming to explore, the architecture, all that kind of thing, has really increased notably, really, in the last decade. And whereas it was a cathedral that was probably not much visited, now it's really picking up on that whole sense of Newcastle as a really important cultural and historic venue, really.
There's been a stat that says there's a 22% rise in weekly worshippers, underlying the word worshippers, over the past 10 years. What sort of changes have you witnessed? Obviously, more visitors coming. Have you changed how you do things?
Well, one of the things we've done is to try and respond to the number of tourists and visitors by we've developed a chaplaincy scheme. So as well as having welcomers who invite people to come and explore, we also have chaplain on duty, and on the hour we have prayers, a fairly informal set of prayers led by the chaplain, so that we kind of meet both people's, trying to meet people both as tourists and visitors, but also to make sure we articulate clearly the spiritual dimensions of the place. And we have found that's been enormously appreciated, and some of the conversations that chaplains have had with visitors have been, quite remarkable. So I think that meeting the both end of, we're on the borderlines as a cathedral between being a place of worship and being an historic asset, and so trying to find a way of bridging that and making sure the Christian heart of the place is still understood and enjoyed and expressed and experienced.
What sort of groups go on at your cathedral? Would it be like a normal parish church, or would it feel very different?
I think it's different in the fact that because of our location, one of the things we've been developing is trying to meet the needs of the nighttime economy. We've, for several years, hosted the Street Pastor Scheme, and that's located in the cathedral and goes out to care for the vulnerable and the fragile members of the kind of nighttime economy, as it were, people who need pastoral care for whatever reason. And more recently, we've been developing a night church model, so that the church is actually open Friday nights from time to time, to enable people to come and find a bit of stillness, a bit of peace, some spiritual exploration in a kind of informal context. And that's something that's really caught the imagination of quite a lot of people. And we had people coming to a late night Compline service, 200 or 300 people attending that, which has been an eye-opener really for us, and a kind of challenge to us to try and respond to that in a more regular and intentional way.
One of the things that's often picked up is everyone is very busy and you can drop into a cathedral in an anonymous type way. Do you think that is one of the attractions?
I think it's often the starting point and people want to come to explore, but I think what people have really discovered is that when they do drop in, whether it's to worship or indeed to visit, that what they'll find is a community that occupies that place and is welcoming and is open to and inclusive to people. And I think that's one of the things that's been very significant in cathedral growth in every respect, whether both in worship or indeed in developing groups and responding to the needs of the community. So that's, it's not just the anonymity, it is the fact that permission is offered, but for anybody to come whenever and for whatever purpose, but that there is an opportunity on visiting and becoming part of that community to engage at a deeper level and take that on another stage.
Lastly, cathedrals all around the country, you made the point, some are in leafy green areas. You're all quite different, aren't you? How do you all relate together?
We have a national network of cathedrals. The Association of English Cathedrals and also the deans meet regularly, and so do staff who have a particular responsibility, like education or like pastoral care or worship. So we learn a lot from each other, really. And although we are in very different contexts, some very urban, some much more rural and country town, there are things that we share in common. There's much to learn from each other. And it's a great community of a learning community, really. Cathedrals attract both, quite often attract the marginal and the fragile and the vulnerable. And certainly we have Eddie the Tramp, who regularly sleeps in the cathedral, and other people who, you know, are not widely accepted and wouldn't be accepted in other places and in other institutions, really. And I think that's quite important that we, even the sparrow has found herself a nest in the house of God.
Churches and communities from around the country have been collecting supplies to give to the migrants who are living in a camp at Calais. In a moment, we'll hear from one vicar who travelled to the jungle, as the camp has been named. But first, the Venerable Jan McFarlane, who's the Archdeacon of Norwich, spoke to BBC Five Live about the BBC's decision to broadcast films from the camp on Songs of Praise. She told presenter Nikki Campbell that the situation there isn't as straightforward as simply condemning the migrants for trying to break the law.
A lot of us have been very concerned about some of the language that's been used in some of the national press this past week, because obviously the language that we use is important. It affects our attitudes, and our attitudes then affect our actions. So while I don't think any of us can pretend that we have any easy answers about how to help these migrants and what in fact should happen to them, any language that just calls them a swarm and groups them all together and dehumanises them, that's going to affect how we act. So I think the fact that Songs of Praise came from the camp at Calais, they did what all good Christians should be doing, and that's giving a voice to the voiceless, and that's exactly what we heard last night.
Jan McFarlane, the Archdeacon of Norwich. The Reverend Jeremy Putnam from All Saints Church in Truro travelled to Calais earlier this week with supplies he and his community had collected. I started by asking him what they found when they got there.
Well, it kind of hits you straight away, the kind of conditions that they're living in. Before you even get to the camp, as you drive towards the camp itself, you can see the new fencing that has been put up around the terminal. And you've got this 1 mile long fence with the razor wire along the top. It stands about 15 foot high, and it leads all the way towards the new camp. And then suddenly you're hit with the just incredible conditions that they're having to live in. Tents made of tarpaulin and sheets of black plastic, litter everywhere, sodden mattresses for sleeping on. Just the conditions and the smell as well is horrid.
Now, we'll come back to a little bit about what response you got when you went, but I wanted to ask you, first of all, why did you want to get involved in doing something?
Well, it came about accidentally. You know how kind of the Holy Spirit works and kind of presents something to you, and then you feel like you're being called to act and respond. Well, it kind of happened accidentally. We had this strange connection with Cornwall Roller Derby through a friend and a member of the church who said, did you fancy kind of being a collection point for donations for the migrants in Calais, and we thought, well, actually, let's really get behind this. This is a really worthwhile cause. All the media coverage up until that point had been very much centred around the immigration issue, and we knew that the other side of this story was about the human issues, the humanitarian issue that was not being talked about and not being shown. And this was directly addressing those issues and directly addressing the needs that was so so prevalent in the camp in Calais. So we didn't hesitate for too long, but we had no idea the kind of response that we would get. And then as the week went on, we just saw all these people coming to the church to offer their donations and collections from all over Cornwall and Devon as well. And it just snowballed. It was incredible.
Now, there has been lots of criticism in the media of people saying, why would you be helping people who are trying to break the law?
Yeah, well, we did. We knew that the immigration issue was a very emotive subject. And when we put ourselves out there and said we were doing this, we kind of knew we would get some criticism. But the overwhelming response has been of one of generosity and compassion. And, you know, the messages that I've had to say thank you and well done far outnumber the negative comments that we've received. And the negative comments have been really around the issue of immigration rather than the human need and what they're going through. Now, the majority of people can understand that, you know, that these are human beings and that, you know, we should show compassion. But there was a small minority that struggled to kind of understand why we were doing this.
Now, when you got to Calais, and I know you had a delayed journey, so it was already quite fraught when you got there, what was the response from people who were there and how did you hand stuff out?
Well, we worked really closely with a Catholic organisation that is based in Calais called Secours Catholique. So we had someone that we were meeting when we were over there. The organisation has a warehouse in the town centre at Calais. So we were able to take all the donations. We had 80 boxes of bedding, blankets and clothing and shoes, toiletries, all sorts. We took that to the warehouse. We unloaded all that we had. And then with the representative from Secours Catholique, we were able to go into the camp with him, and he was able to introduce us to a few people and for us to see firsthand the conditions and to meet some of the migrants and to hear their story, which was just amazing, just to be that close to hearing these people and to understanding what they've gone through in order to get to this place and to try to get over to Britain, that last desperate hope to start a new life. It was really incredible, actually, the way that as you walk around the camp, you can see that the population is made up of so many different nationalities. You have Eritrean and Ethiopians, you have Sudanese, Iraqis, Afghans, Syrians, and they're all living side by side in this camp. And you have Christians and Muslims living side by side. And there's this amazing sense of kind of family and fellowship and unity. And one of the first things that I kind of came away thinking was, actually, in some really strange way, this is a great example of humanity, that, you know, people living side by side in unity and fellowship. And in many ways, it's a better example of how human beings should be to one another than many other parts of the world and maybe even parts of our own country. But it was the conditions, the context of that, which shocked me the most, really, and what they're having to put up with.
And what are they having to put up with?
Well, just, you know, having just one set of clothes. So, you know, just how do you wash the clothes when you're only wearing the one set that you have? They have one meal a day, which is provided for them by the government, and they have to wait hours to receive that one meal. There is very limited fresh water. There's just a couple of taps dotted around the camp. And just everything gets really cold and wet, so you don't have to go far to look into, you know, to see a tent or a makeshift shelter. And to see the conditions they're living in, that, you know, the mattress might be sodden wet, just filthy and disgusting, and some of them are sleeping on just straight on the ground. So it's no way of living at all. It's horrific.
And what was the mood of the people who were there?
Well, that's the other surprising thing, that there was this sense of kind of strength and kind of a spirited living as well, because they were all in this together. So there was this kind of feeling of fellowship. There was music playing. There was people talking with one another. There was We brought a couple of footballs with us, and you know, there was some guys kicking the football around and having fun. So during the day, obviously there isn't much for them to do other than to spend time with one another. So they find ways of getting on and enjoying each other's company. So yeah, that was really good to see that kind of spirited fun and fellowship that was going on as well.
Did you come away feeling like you made any kind of a difference?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. We had BBC crew with us as well, so we were able to kind of share with certainly the Southwest and BBC Spotlight some of what we were doing and the donations that had been given by community and folk in Cornwall. I think the more that small groups and grassroots groups around the country are able to do for the migrants and refugees at Calais, the more the human side of the story will come out, and the government might then think about doing something more permanent for improving their conditions. I know, and I feel really strongly about this, that you know, the answer to our immigration issue is not to build a one-mile wall along the terminal at Calais. You know, that's no way of showing compassion. I think there has to be this balance of understanding how we deal with the number of migrants coming into the EU, but treating them as human beings and showing compassion. Because Jesus, you know, taught us that we should love our neighbours as ourselves, and that means the people we live alongside in this country and work alongside, but it also means those that are on our doorstep in Calais as well. So we have a real responsibility to ensure that these people are treated as human beings. And building a wall is definitely not the answer.
Jeremy Putnam. The Church of England's rural officer is urging people to buy British farmed produce and support the dairy industry amid falling milk prices. Canon Jill Hopkinson says it takes roughly 10 litres of milk to make a kilogram of hard cheese, such as cheddar, so it's important that we try and buy as much cheese, yoghurt and butter that is produced in the UK from British milk. Roughly half the milk produced in the UK is used to make dairy products. I spoke to Peter Riley from the Farming Community Network, who support farmers and their families. I started by asking him what life is like for dairy farmers at the moment.
Life is becoming very difficult for dairy farmers. I think, as everyone knows, those who've seen the television, heard the radio, read the newspapers, that the prices that some dairy farmers are getting for their milk is simply not sufficient for them to be profitable and productive. And indeed, there are a number of dairy farmers who are now looking seriously at whether or not they have a future in the business, and indeed some dairy farmers who are leaving dairying altogether.
It's not just dairy farmers, though, presumably, you hear from.
No, it isn't. It's clear that the prices for lamb and the prices for grain are under pressure, and we're beginning to see problems with the prices paid for beef. So it's an all-round problem for farming at present.
This must be something that's very worrying to you as a network, that potentially people are considering leaving because they're unlikely to be replaced, presumably, once they decide to stop farming.
It's very difficult and very distressing for farmers. You have to remember that in many cases the farm and the farm business and the farmhouse has been handed down over generations. So the decision to leave farming altogether is distressing and quite upsetting, not only for the farmer himself or herself, but also for the family. And it makes life difficult in terms of which way forward, what do we do now, where are we going to live, what will happen. And it's at the occasions like that that our volunteers are able to walk with the farmers and support them as they make their way forward and back to the life that they can lead.
Now, the Church of England's rural officer wrote a blog this week which was encouraging people to buy British milk, something that I know that you have also picked up on in your spring newsletter about backing British farming. Presumably you would support what she has said.
Most certainly. It's very important for all of us to back British farming, and this means that when you go shopping, have a look, read the labels very carefully, and if you can, buy British rather than imported foodstuffs.
What support do you at the FCN offer to farmers?
We take as our example the two frightened and bewildered disciples who were on their way to Emmaus, and they were joined by a seeming stranger who walked with them. and resolved their problems and quietened their fears. And we term ourselves as walking with those farmers who need practical support and usually pastoral support as well. We don't take on their problem, but we're by their side and we guide them and help them through them resolving their own difficulties and problems. And we will stay with them for as long as it needs.
And I suppose in farming, it's difficult because it's hard to distinguish from your working life and your home life. It's all rolled into one.
Yes, it is. Farming is, as we all appreciate, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can't take any breaks. You don't have a weekend off. The animals have got to be fed. Cattle have got to be milked. Poultry's got to be fed and so on. You can't just say, right, I think I'll take the weekend off. They can fend for themselves. And, of course, it's very often a family business. There is a farmhouse, and farmers are there not only to keep their business going, but to look after and provide for the family. And also remember, farmers live out in rural isolation to a great degree, and it's always very difficult. You can't chat things over with your neighbour if that neighbour lives about 4 miles away. So it is a difficult lifestyle. It's a testing lifestyle. And it's usually a business that includes the family.
Apart from buying British, which we've already talked about, what would you ask church communities to do to support farmers?
Farming is very dependent on the weather, something over which we have no control. If everybody has the opportunity, they could pray for productive weather, for suitable weather, and pray for farmers and farming in general. We do rely very heavily on our farmers, not only to produce the nation's food, but also they're the people who have the responsibility of looking after God's earth. They're the people who clear the ditches and mend the walls and make sure that there is sufficient grass for cattle to eat, etc., etc. So it's not just a question of producing, it's also a question of protecting and preserving.
And if you'd like to find out more about the work of the Farming Community Network, you can go to their website, which is www.fcn.org.uk. And you can find Jill Hopkinson's blog on the front page of the Church of England website. That's it for this week's podcast. I'm Gillian Moody. Thanks for listening.